Good morning.
Welcome to Bible study. Today we come together to hear and perhaps to speak, thine is the glory. My name is Paul Rohde. For those of you who've come into the village through the week, I'm a pastor in New Ulm, Minnesota. It's been my privilege to lead us through the word this week. I want to say already how thankful I am. This has been a really good week for me, and I appreciate your participation. I also have an invitation for you. If you would like to stay when we're through at 10 o'clock, I also invited the 7:45 group back, and we will spend some time in prayer as a group. It has seemed awkward to me to talk about prayer and not pray, though I think that says it too sharply in terms of how we define prayer. I believe we have been attentive and we have been stirred, and there are many senses in which that's deeply prayerful. And at the same time, I think we've been pretty clear that we're talking to each other. And so I thought it would be fitting at the end for us to talk to God. I mean, we could have done that in each of the sessions, but maybe it's just as well to have let the verbs rattle around a bit and perhaps stir new ways of praying. And the other thing is it frees us from any of the awkwardness of being taped, which I would have wanted to be honest with you about had we prayed in each of the sessions. And at the same time at 10 o'clock, we just don't need to worry about that. So for any of you who would like to stay, the folks at 7:45 are coming back. If you have other places that you need to be, we'll make a clear break, and you can certainly be excused. Luke chapter 2. Yesterday I said that because of the kind of didactic character of the piece, we'd have to stretch our imaginations to give it narrative and character and sight. So today I hope that our imaginations are just chock full as we meet Simeon and Anna, these elderly characters who are faithfully in the temple day by day and who speak their prayer. I know for me, it isn't even a small step. I can't even hear the characters without names like Sigurd and Oren and Ed and Wilma, and they just keep coming. For the sages and saints I felt privileged to know and to listen to, we'll take some time. If you feel inclined to share a testimony, you certainly may. First we will read, starting with chapter 2, verse 25. Now there was a man in Jerusalem whose name was Simeon, and this man was righteous and devout, looking for the consolation of Israel, and the Holy Spirit was upon him. And it had been revealed to him by the Holy Spirit that he should not see death before he had seen the Lord's Christ. I think that verse is a wonderful statement about life. That we should not see death before we see life, before we see the Lord's Christ, before we see, period. And I am really taken by the power of the visual verbs all the way through our study. I had not planned that, but how many times have we heard look, see, watch, observe in the narrative? And once again, it had been revealed that he would not see death before he had seen the Lord's Christ. I think we too many times, unless we're really steeped in a contemplative tradition, assume that seeing is automatic. That of course we will have seen. This is sort of an aside, but I think about the mountains, that of course we would have seen the mountains. How could you come to Holden and not see the mountains? I think distraction is powerful enough even here that you may not have seen it? Or how can you have lived with someone and not seen their love? It happens. It happens. And the power of prayer is to help see the power of contemplation, of study, reflection, is to bring us out of blindness, or worse, out of distraction, so that we might focus and that we might see. The aside is that I have this nifty essay. I've admitted to those of you who were here earlier in the week that I grew up in South Dakota, and I do not apologize for it. And I was given an essay sometime when I was living in Minnesota, probably it's when I was in seminary, by a teacher at Southwest State in Marshall, an English teacher, who was sick and tired of people he called enamored with vertical landscapes, who didn't see anything in the prairie. So he writes this essay about the difference between a wood's eye and a prairie eye. The difference between a vertical landscape and a horizontal landscape. I mean, a vertical landscape stands up and you see it all at once, right? Buckskin, copper, dumbbell, there they are. They're right in front of you. Prairie landscape takes a lot longer to see. Life is, of course, both vertical and horizontal. But over time, it strikes me that we experience time as a horizontal, largely a horizontal movement. And maybe seeing takes a little more effort there. Simeon has had this revelation that he would not see death before he had seen the Lord's Christ. And inspired by the Spirit, you're not noticing the way the Spirit talk goes here, that's very characteristic of Luke. Every movement in Luke happens by the Spirit. And Luke's careful to identify that, not to assume it, not to take it for granted. Inspired by the Spirit, Simeon came into the temple. And when the parents brought in the child Jesus to do for him according to the custom of the law, he took him up in his arms and blessed God. Lord, now let your servant depart in peace, according to your word. For my eyes have seen your salvation, which you have prepared in the presence of all people, a light for revelation to the Gentiles, and for glory to your people, Israel. Since we're working in the verb to see, we'll start with that one. The thing I want us to notice here is the change of tense and mood. Most of the times we've encountered the verb to see, it's been in the imperative mood. See, watch, look. Here it's in the indicative mood, and it is in a perfect tense, which is saying continuing action up to the present. I have seen. That is a continuing, past but continuing action, the tense. I want us to think for a few moments about prayer as the power of saying what we have seen. Okay? Of bringing to language the gifts of sight, the moments of revelation, the blessings of God. I think the power of language here works a couple different ways. First, when we've had a very powerful experience or an intense gift, or better, when we've had even an ordinary gift, that there is the pressure to speak it, to say, isn't that magnificent? Or even to say, good dinner. It was a good dinner. You know what I mean? That the first pressure is the pressure of experience, to bring the experience to language, which is part of the gift of prayer. I think the second is to say the way language intensifies the experience. That the experience is wider when you've said it, more intense. Are we getting any comments about that? Go ahead.
Well, it reminds me of a time when I was traveling with someone, and for a time we separated, and when we got back together again, Scott said that he didn't realize, he had no idea how much he would miss not traveling with other companions, because he would experience something and want to share it, and didn't have the power of being able to share the language about the experience with another person.
Didn't have, because there weren't the companions there.
Yes.
But sometimes, even when the companions are there, we don't have, unless there's a discipline of, call it contemplation, call it prayer, reflection, to say, this is good. And I thank God for this. Then kind of interesting for me, each day this week, how there's all this great stuff happening that just speaks to where I was hoping the study would go. Yesterday, Ione, who did matins this morning, said in Bible study largely what she said in matins. And she said, the older I get, the closer together the mountaintop experiences are. And then if you were at the spiritual direction session, Sheila said, I'm living in my chalet with a child, and I see in the face of that child the face of God, which is a very distinct echo of Simeon's insight. It's a really interesting question to me. Does Simeon see something unique in the baby Jesus? Or does he say over the baby Jesus what he said over every baby in the temple, when the temple is blessed? But it is that Luke remembers that Simeon says this. Now, I think that's an interesting question about anointing and about the Messiahship of Jesus at this stage of the game. I think too often we read it and it's like there was some kind of halo around Jesus. And that gets there too fast, maybe. That there is a gift of sight in the marvel of children. And in that magical combination that is elderly people with children. Comments? Questions? Well, I said, I hoped your imagination was full of people. I have been so full of reflection on and gratitude for my friend Oren, as I'm teaching this morning, that I will start by telling you about my friend Oren. He was the chairman of my internship committee. I interned in 1980-81, Oak Park, Illinois. And he was 80 at the time I was interning. Okay, so accepted that assignment at the wonderful age of 80. Oren had two theories about aging. One is that one of the reasons he thought people went senile is that by the sheer law of gravity, blood is running out of your head. So in his 60s, he decided to try to reverse the process. And he started doing calisthenics on his head. And in his 80s, he was still doing it. He would stand on his head every day. I think he continued up until 86 or 87. And then his kids finally said, Dad, this has been a real neat thing, but it's time now. So he did calisthenics on his head every day. And his second theory was that you need to be learning. And so he learned wood carving, in his 70s. He taught himself to play a chord organ in his 80s. And in his 90s, he stayed current with computer software. Amazing, amazing guy. Would write us these wonderful letters that were simply descriptive of his life and his gratitude for it. He would say, "Paul, to live long enough to watch your children grandparent or your grandchildren parent and to like what you see." Descriptive. Maybe Oren helps me name our fear of being pompous or arrogant, and so we don't quite dare say it's good. But how impoverished are we, and are those around us, our traveling companions, if we don't have the courage and the freedom to say, "This is gift, and it's good." It's kind of interesting that Simeon connects this with his freedom then to depart. Having seen this gift, he's free then to let go. It's clear to me that not all of you were in the village Monday night. I cited the book Tuesdays with Maury by Mitch Albom. If you've not read it, it is a must read. A little tiny book about a college student who sees his college professor, his old favorite college professor, on Nightline, of all places, Ted Koppel, because Maury is diagnosed with ALS and decides that since it's been his vocation his whole life to teach, now that he has ALS, he's going to teach people to die. And he does it with such vigor that even Ted Koppel picks up on it, puts him on Nightline. This student sees him and decides he needs to go back to see his professor. And he goes to visit him on Tuesdays. And the book is a record of their conversations. Maury both tells Mitch to let go, to learn to let go, and to experience life fully. Maury hears that as a contradiction.
Mitch hears it
as a contradiction. Thank you. Maury says, "No, it's not a contradiction, because we can't let go until we experience fully." And most of us just start experiencing, and then we experience either risk or fear or pain, something else. So we pull back, and therefore only experience fear or the fear of pain, and don't ever really experience fully. So Maury's wisdom is experience fully so that you're able to let go. Seems to me that is part of this movement of naming, speaking, bringing to language, that we may not have experienced fully until we've tried to relate it to another person and then been able to let go. Comments? Questions? Then what do you see? It's been our question this week. I think you're tired. Folks at 7:45 were too. Seeing, but a little less vigorous. Talking about it. And his father and his mother marveled at what was said about him. It is no slight thing that the scripture allows us, especially in these early chapters, to see the life of Jesus through the eyes of his parents. It has to have been an incredible movement of God for them. And Simeon blessed them and said to Mary, his mother, "Behold, this child is set for the fall and rising of many in Israel, and for a sign that is spoken against, and a sword will pierce through your own soul also, and thoughts out of many hearts may be revealed. I read that, and there's somebody at 7:45 who, before I said anything else, said, "This is the good news of the Lord." We all kind of laughed. But I was glad he said it, because in my own experience, I have these daughters, you know. And it's amazing to me how often people will make some comment about them, who they are and what they see in them. And then they will look at me and say, "They're going to break your heart." And it had never occurred to me to say, "This is the good news of the Lord." Next time somebody says it to me, that's what I'm going to say. So I got a good gift this morning at Holden. Kind of interesting, I think, how closely blessing and curse come together. And so many times in our study this week, the curse has come first. There's been the hunger of the Israelites in the wilderness. And they cried, you know, they complained to Moses and Aaron about their hunger. And then came the blessing of bread and the blessing of daily. Or there was the curse of the thorn in the flesh for Paul of yesterday. And then came the blessing of the sufficiency of grace, that the two have come together, and that it works the opposite direction too. Simeon has started with the blessing, with seeing the salvation, the light. One of the things I didn't comment about that yet is the inclusivity of it, the power, that it is a revelation for all people, a revelation to the Gentiles and the glory of your people Israel. I think a part of our reluctance to speak our blessings is a limitation of individualism, that we are not inclined to see that our blessing is gift to others too, and that others' blessing is also gift to us. I think we're more inclined in our culture to see that if you've got a great blessing, probably there is less for me. It's a very diminishing interpretation of each of our gifts. That a gift to any one of us is a gift to all of us. I mean, I like to imagine that if one of you would discover a cure for AIDS, how narrow it would be if you said, "Thank God I've got it. This is what needs to happen to stop the dreadful epidemic." And if we were so narrow as to say, "Well, wish I had thought of it." I mean, it's like, come on, this gift is gift for all. But now on to what Simeon says about how it is that blessing carries with it, at the very least, responsibility or agony in its use. There will be those who resist, who refuse to see, who are threatened, and pain for his mother. A sword will pierce your own soul too. I wonder if piercing is a verb we want to add to our prayer vocabulary. Open, might be pierced by the depth and radicality of what God will do. Comments or questions? Okay. And there was a prophetess, Anna, the daughter of Phanuel of the tribe of Asher. She was of a great age, having lived with her husband 7 years from her virginity, and as a widow till she was 84. So interesting to me how the scripture paints here the detail. I mean, 7 years of marriage and 84 years of widowhood that it's got to be stated precisely. Not sure all that that's about, but it seems to me that some of it is about the length of a very difficult life. My sense is that that may be true of widowhood in every culture, but certainly in this culture where a widow has no property, no sustenance by her own power. 84 years, here is Anna, who has persevered. She did not depart from the temple, worshiping with fasting and prayer night and day. And coming up at that very hour, she gave thanks to God and spoke of him to all who were looking for the redemption of Jerusalem. She gave thanks to God and spoke of him to all who were looking for the redemption of Jerusalem. I was about ready to make a leap yesterday. Took a new RSV back and thought, it's really getting to be time. Though this has been my Bible for years. And then I discovered that the new RSV used praised God instead of thanked God. I don't want to push that distinction unnecessarily, but I wanted Anna this morning to be thanking God because it was the only prayer of thanks we'd included in the study this week. And for me, it is the summa word, thanks, gratitude. When I am old, I shall. Well, I hope, among other things, I shall be grateful. The parish I used to serve, we were a big staff. So our practice for our birthdays is that on our own birthday, we'd bring treats for the rest of the staff. It was my birthday one year, and I brought my treats. We were sitting there having my party, and you can know his background in this. I am very much like my grandfather. And it delights me that there are people in his hometown who still call me Little Elmer. But anyway, I said that year, I don't remember what was going on, but I was on my high horse about something. And so I said to them, I said, you know, when I'm old, I'm going to be opinionated, outspoken, and jolly. And it occurs to me that lots of us manage to be opinionated and outspoken, but we miss the jolly. My grandpa was opinionated and outspoken and jolly. So anyway, I said this to my colleagues, and they looked at me and said, this is a change? More seriously, when I am old, I hope I will be grateful. Ione told us this morning that the mountaintops are getting closer together. And Sheila said in her session yesterday that praise gets closer together. That for her in prayer, as she matures in it, and I think it's more important to use the word mature than age, because I don't think we can assume it's an automatic process by sheer longevity. I mean, we could wish for that. But in the exercise of it, in the identifying of gifts, the speaking them, naming them, sharing them, releasing them, gratitude is intensified. I think part of why it's such a wonderful word for prayer, thanks, is that it is so whole, and every part of you is thankful. And I think part of it is that it is a word which is still well understood. You know, you say the word love, that's a wonderful word, but you have no idea if it's understood. But I think you say the word gratitude, and there is in that the receiving of something you cannot explain, for which you cannot take total credit, but which you need to participate Okay? You need to participate in it to be grateful. You aren't grateful for food you don't eat. And maybe you're even more grateful for food you get to help prepare. You know, that kind of thing. That is still understood to say, I am grateful. Now, I would also want to be clear that I don't say that to try to set up a new law. My fear is that you would hear it and think, yes, I should be grateful. To should be grateful is not to be grateful, it is to be shoulded. And there is a whole world apart. I mean, gratitude is the celebration of where you are and of what you have. And should is the, I think, the kind of haunting, almost cursing experience of what you are not yet. And it can be helpful, I don't mean that, but it certainly isn't gratitude. Gratitude cannot be forced. It seems to me that gratitude is, on some levels, seeing the gift. So that's a piece of prayer. Prayer is often a recitation of gift, of bringing to language. I have seen your salvation, Simeon says. Or it is of telling this one to everyone who's there. Can't you hear, Anna? I mean, can't you see Ion this morning at Matins just needing to tell us all about this village? Where we are and the gift it has been for her and how she is real in receiving it. I mean, there's a sense in which it is presence of gift and awareness of that presence. But better than that, it seems to me, it is presence of giver. It is of the one who has given a gift. So you watch the kids come out of Narnia, you know, with their projects that we all have to figure out a way to get out of the village. Why do they do big projects in Narnia? It was wonderful last year. My parents were here with us, so we could say, Grandma would just love it. And then Grandma could figure out a way. But you hear what happens in the presence of giver, that even when the gift it's kind of a mixed blessing. You see parent after parent saying, wow, did you paint this or draw this or make that, you know? Because the giver is present. And that changes the gift altogether. That prayer, I don't want to say finally, ultimately, but or repeatedly, is the presence of the giver of all. And so when I see Anna, you know, 84 years in her widowhood, in the temple day and night, fasting and praying, and then seeing Mary and Joseph and the baby Jesus, then, you know, quietly walking around to say, here it is, the gift, the giver. I just gotta tell you what I saw this morning. The fulfillment of our hopes is among us. And then she gives thanks. Thanks that she saw and that she gets to tell, to celebrate, to experience. And I think back on our week, how gratitude needs to be not only gratitude for bread, but gratitude for hunger. Not only gratitude for the sufficiency of grace in the name of Paul, put gratitude in a way for the thorns that help us know that sufficiency. Remember, we talked about how you can't describe the sufficiency of grace without the thorn. It was the thorn that made that sufficiency. And I wonder about Hannah. We started with Hannah the first of the week. If hers is not only gratitude for Eli and for his presence to her, his capacity to hear her prayer and validate her prayer so that her countenance is no longer sad, already I believe there was gratitude. I feel better. What a gift to have spoken and heard, been validated, and then lifted by her prayer. Gratitude certainly for Samuel. I wonder if she ever got to the point of being grateful for the wait. Yeah, I'm here to tell you I'm not there yet. Gratitude for gifts is part of the discipline of prayer. And certainly gratitude for the way faith, the promise, the word is always pointing beyond them to the God who gives them, to the God who is trusted, not the gift that's trusted, but the God who is trusted while the gift is here. I wonder about getting to the place of gratitude. Maybe some of you who've got a generation on me can speak to that. Comments? Questions? Reflections?
I think it's interesting that in the prayers of the people on Sunday, we offer opportunity for people to name their concerns, and the whole congregation fills up with names and whatever. But I would say almost 99% of the time, when you offer the opportunity to give thanks, they don't know what to say. I think that's a sad commentation on how we live life. Or maybe they just don't think they need to say the thanks. I don't know.
Oh, do you really think that?
No.
No, I don't either.
But there's got to be some talk of that.
And some practice of it. Yeah. Some practice of it that when you claim your gift, that frees me to claim mine. Mm-hmm. And to celebrate them together. I think one of the whole things about the discipline of prayer is getting past the assumption that seeing is automatic. Mm-hmm. It is not automatic. We live in a culture that moves through it so fast. You know, 75 miles an hour, you really don't see much. The prayer is this stopping to see. And a piece of that is to see the gifts that there may be thankfulness mm-hmm. for them. Mm-hmm. I think, was there another hand up here? Go ahead.
Sandra and I were talking yesterday, and we were expressing the sweetness of the rain and the coolness. And we both agreed that it was sweet and it was cool, but it was sweeter and cooler because it had been so hot. And we would not have appreciated the sweetness and the coolness if it had been moderate, very moderate. In fact, it might even be an inconvenience.
Yes, that's right.
And yet it was the same rain and it was the same coolness.
Mm-hmm. Well, when we started with Simeon, we started by talking about this bringing to language, and this comes back to your comment. Because when we're thinking just about spontaneous language, there are moments and there are times and places when exuberance and affirmation and acclamation come spontaneously. I don't mean to say there aren't. But as I kind of watch people, watch myself move through life, it's troubling to me that if something is wrong, by George, it comes to language. Mm-hmm. If there is food we don't like, it's like you can't eat it. It's a real effort to eat it without saying so. But you can eat all kinds of things you do like, and maybe not feel the same pressure to say it. Do you hear what I'm saying? That somehow the complaint comes more spontaneously. And I've also been thinking about my friend Murray, because Mary Boies is doing all these things about our relationship to Judaism. My friend Murray is a Lutheran pastor who is a converted Jew, grew up in Brooklyn, and did his doctoral dissertation on the laments. So he's got wonderful insights into complaining, not the least of which is that he does it about sermons. I mean, he's a pastor. He said, you know, why is it you can have 60 people tell you it was a really good sermon, and then somebody comes through and says, how dare you, or what was that, or where did that come from, and which comment do you focus on? Mm-hmm. And it's sort of interesting when you talk about the 99%, because it goes the other way, mm-hmm. that 90% can be satisfied, but it's so easy to be focused on that gap, I should have somehow done it better for them. Mm-hmm. And a marvelous corrective to that is a focus on gift and on thankfulness and on what has been seen. When we were talking about this day, our daily bread, remember the voice among us who talked about how important memory is? Because life is this. It is this day. It is only this day. And when I haven't got this day what I really want, whether that is by way of my hunger or my hunger for love or whatever, important to be able to remember what I've had, for memory to bring that in. And again, isn't thankfulness or praise or Simeon's recitation of what he's seen an important part of that discipline? See, I don't think forgive and forget is a particularly biblical notion. I think forgive and remember is a more biblical notion, that the Bible is very concerned that we remember. Not that we remember the curse, or maybe even that we relive or continue to act out the curse, but that we remember that the curse was there so that we can remember its release. Remember the heat, so the rain is sweet. Yeah, that's good. Other comments? Go ahead.
On the point of expressing something and then being able to move on, personal point, I experience often in relationships or in situations where something happens, a person says something, or some connection is made between me and a person. It could be a negative connection, it could be a positive connection, that sometimes in hurry, or I mean in haste, or out of fear of how the person might react to my expressing something, or out of some ambivalence in myself about it, I don't express it. And I've certainly experienced many times when then I'm stuck with it. I suppose the most difficult of it is when you're in a marriage or you're in a relationship and you're very much attracted to someone else, and you keep it to yourself. You don't sort of bring it even to the surface of your own feelings and consciousness. You don't own it, let alone express it. How that can be a place where you then get stuck. It can be that significant, or it can be as significant as a interchange with a person in a conversation that is a bad interchange, and you let yourself get sucked. I think that's what I heard. And how clear you feel, or can feel, if you're able to bring it out, express it, than if you hold it inside.
Thank you. Yeah, absolutely. Well, as you're talking, keep thinking about that observation of the number of children for whom speech development doesn't happen automatically, and they become hyperactive. Mm. And speech therapy helps their hyperactivity, because speech is that kind of release, which I think you're describing. And then to bring that back to our prayer life, I mean, I can't help but think of Hannah as you're talking about the awkwardness of human relationships, where she has this burden, this emptiness, this infertility that simply will not go away, and Peninnah, who's just irritating her with it, and Elkanah, who doesn't get it, and the times when, even though you say it, it doesn't get heard, and it's not satisfactory, and the curse of setting ourselves up in human relationship that somehow our communication among each other should accomplish everything, is really unfortunate. I believe that people need to be trained to be good listeners, and that there's wonderful power in our ability to listen to one another. And I simply have to recognize that there are times that I cannot hear, and that I must not condemn the person who cannot hear me or understand me. And that prayer is this gift of one who hears and who is with us and who invites and welcomes and opens all of the kinds of asking and all of the kinds of getting we've tried to explore. Other comments, go ahead.
You brought up the point that I think you said, maybe I'm more graphic than you are, but giving an opportunity to unload. I mean, something's bothering you, get it out in the open. And you expressed a minute ago your reaction to the one person who does unload on you. How do you reconcile that? I mean, you've got the receiver who only concentrates on the person who unloaded it. You feel good because you got rid of all this garbage, but now what do you do with it?
Pray for your bastards.
Thank you. You're absolutely right. Well, the thing that I do with it is try to hope that unloading was helpful. And again, one of the gifts of aging and experience is to take it personally long enough to know that there is nothing to be gained by taking it personally. Being 40 has its advantages. And that is one of them, to say that there is something that to thank the person for being honest and to hope for being able to express it was helpful. And see if there's something in it you can learn from. But fundamentally, to know that unloading, if it's unloading, is that person's agenda more than it's yours. Is that too slippery?
Well, I tend to be one of those kind of people that unless my friends would say differently, I tend to internalize or to find other ways to exhale, so to speak.
Okay.
I can go and work someplace until it no longer bothers me.
Yeah.
other people have to get it off their chest right now and let it fall where it may. Mm-hmm. And sometimes if you're the receiver of that thing time and time and time again, you get a little tired of it, but I don't know. I'm not verbalizing this very well, but
yes, you are.
Yeah, you are, because we are really on to something, and you are making me wonder if some of that, and what I was saying about, you know, Hannah's situation and the people around her who couldn't understand, kept kind of narrowing her place and forcing her into, it was already a very narrow place, and just kept pushing her back. If some of that is what prompted me to do this study and to find a place to say to people, tell God. Because I am in a place where it is my privilege and my call as intercessor to receive all of that. And then it's like, enough. Enough, oh, wonderful. But I don't want to say that to inhibit what I really believe needs to happen. When you were talking about exhaling, I was thinking another metaphor, okay? The metaphor that I was thinking was vomiting. And, you know, when the only thing worse than doing it is not doing it. When it needs to happen, it needs to happen. And it's not pretty. And this is a wonderful place to say, God bless nurses. You know, none of us would choose, I think, to do it in front of somebody else or on somebody else. But sometimes it happens. It just happens. I mean, and it happens to parents. Mm-hmm. Happens to parents a lot. And what we're offering here is an openness. How many times have we echoed on Renown to say with open hands? And prayer is this openness to acknowledge in us that God knows, and to exercise the gift God gives us to realize God knows. It can be a very healing thing. And precisely, most of us seek to go off and do it somewhere else, thankfully. And it's really a lot better when it's over.
But there's I think that there needs to be a clear distinction, at least in my mind, that there's some venting that is healing, and there's some venting that just keeps venting.
Yes, there is.
And that's the venting that you wish that they would go say, God, God, God. Mm-hmm. But the venting where somebody comes and really hears something, not from you necessarily, but from their own words, then that's a wonderful venting because they... something happens.
Yeah. The word, you know, a couple, I mean, there are all kinds of combinations and options. What I hear you describing is stuckness. And you know, to be stuck in venting, or stuck in denial, or stuck in repressing, or stuck in any other place, is a real scary kind of thing. I mean, stuck in putting it on the same other person is a pattern that... But the other possibility is that somebody vents and it triggers something in you. So then you vent back. That can get real explosive. Too. And I mean, can be helpful, but is also the kind of fireworks that need to be handled very carefully.
One of the aspects of criticism to me personally from someone else is that it does give an opportunity for learning about at least how they feel. And in my office, so we do a survey of every of every parent. I'm an orthodontist, and I treat children primarily, but we treat families of the relationship that we have. And every 6 months, we will send, not every 6 months, but at 6 months, we will send a survey out. And we get about an 80% return on the survey. 99% are so positive that you kind of walk around doing this. And every once in a while, one will come through that you wish you never asked for. But those are the ones that I learned something from. And those are the ones that the staff learned something from. But they also are the ones that hurt the most.
Yeah.
And yet, I often would say, I'm not going to do this anymore. Because I really don't want to hear that 1% or that 10% or whatever that number is. But those are the ones that I learned something from. And those are the things that go around. But they will burden, I'll share these with my staff, and I will burden that staff for 2-3 days with solutions coming up in their mind as to how that even if the thing is so disproportionately untrue, there's an aspect of it, small as it can be, that may well be true, or it could be very true, and you have to deal with it. But I think that those comments that you get as you're shaking hands out are very similar to what I ask for and often get and wish I didn't.
And at the same time, if you stopped asking so as not to hear the 1%, you wouldn't hear the 99%.
Well, I wouldn't hear the 1% for sure. And we would hear some of the 99%, but we would not hear the 99%.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. And be deprived of the learning and all of that.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Not necessarily, not just an observation, as I was thinking about you talking about language and how naming and articulating what you feel is a very important part of prayer. And yet, as a participant and an observer, it seems like in churches or like last night in Vespers, some of the most powerful prayers occur where no words are ever exchanged. And how that paradox is still true on both sides. And I know, and maybe as a pastor you've experienced that too, that there are the congregational prayers, the times of celebrations and concerns that are shared that may sound flat. And yet when you ask people to come to the altar and just be there and have people stand behind and touch, nothing is said, how there's something in the air. And there's a communication there.
Yeah. We had a very good discussion about that at 7:45. The voice that was quick to say, oh, but words are intrusive. And they can be. They can be very intrusive. There is a sense of timing. And frankly, some of that was my sense about our prayer. For some of you who've come in later in the hour, any of the 7:45 folks who want to, we're going to come back at 10 and we're going to have a few moments of prayer. And I anticipate we'll have a lot of silence, too. My sense is that experience and seeing and not seeing and all those combinations need to rattle around before we are ready to pray. Which is not to say that words don't have their function. You know, that one of the ways to preserve memory is to put that experience into language at some point, you know, when you can reflect on it. Even if you can't put the whole experience into language, it will help you record it and recall it. Go ahead.
Just as a follow-on to that, too, I think some of that resolves if one thinks of language more broadly than just the spoken word.
Yeah.
The symbols that we use, that we develop, those are a language of true power. Mm-hmm. And it's perhaps because we save them for moments such as last night, too, that they have that kind of power. Mm-hmm.
Say too that I'm going to help with the prayer time at 10, and part of what we're going to do is do some postures of prayer with our hands. And I think that for me, sometimes I have the words first and then can express them, and sometimes I have it in my body first. And by doing something with my body, then I discover something, which I can mostly put into words, but sometimes not quite. So there's a discovery process that goes back and forth, I think. And prayer is part of that too, that part of prayer that is silent waiting is waiting for the information to come, the discovery, rather than the words out.
For those of you who've not been here all week, Anita got in on Wednesday, and it's like, where have you been all week? Because I've been looking for a liturgical dancer when we talked about Hannah, who had not eaten. Eli's concern for her starts out of the fact that she had not eaten, and she is taken for drunk, you know, and we talked about what her posture must have been like. And I said, were I a liturgical dancer, I would try to show, but it wouldn't be helpful. and with the Israelites in the wilderness, their posture when they're testing the Sabbath and kind of sneaking out to see if the bread is still there. Jesus in Gethsemane. Some of the richest descriptions of Jesus' prayer were not about what he said, but about what people in their mind's eyes saw that he looked like as he flung himself to the ground and in the darkness, in the garden. And for the sake of those of you who weren't here, my sense is that there was very near consensus that in spite of the pictures that have him looking up, gazing, you know, like a commercial for cosmetics, facial cosmetics, most of us see a figure more in a fetal position, with a face that's wrinkled and writhing. And who, in some ways, we maybe got too soon today to what Anna and Simeon looked like without talking about what they looked like. Go ahead, Susan.
I was thinking too of the difference and the connection between public worship, liturgical, ritual prayer.
Yes.
And the prayer of our daily lives. Mm-hmm. In the course of a week of worship at Holden, there is a time for the community to call out verbally the prayers of their hearts in community. There are also prayers that are written almost like poems that someone has prayed over and wrestled with the language until it's burnished and tight and beautiful, that are prayed on behalf of everyone else. And then there are the prayers that have been handed down to us from generation to generation to generation, which we make our own as they're prayed ritually. And then there are those silent prayers whose posture, that evoke a posture of kneeling or open-handedness or weeping or that we experienced last night. And it seems to me that the prayers that come out of a community as they did last night around the cross would probably not be as deep and as possible if we weren't also steeped in the prayers of our ancestors, ritual prayer, and invited to speak prayers aloud. It seems to me that it is a whole constellation, as you have been doing, looking at the verbs for prayers, and to focus in and say there's one true prayer, you know. That's what you've opened up for us. But what I've been thinking liturgically is what we do when we gather for worship is enact publicly and corporately the different postures, the different languages for prayer, and that shape our lives when we aren't at public worship. You know, so if we're only praying when we come together for public ritual, that can't carry the weight of our life of prayer. But on the other hand, to just have a personal life of prayer and never gather that in publicly, we would dry up as well. So I'm really intrigued by this back and forth.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. I mean, that to suggest that that a prayer we might describe as vomiting is something we would do in church would be so paralyzing to us. But when we can do it alone or with someone we trust utterly, then everything we do in church is so much more meaningful. And in reverse, what we do when we are together makes it possible for us to feel the freedom of the gospel to demand or to cry or finally to recognize the gift. Our time is completed. I do have one thing I want to say in conclusion. And that is simply that we would in our journey of faith discover again and again the power of language or the power of God in language. The power of God in languages that are deeper than words to create. So many times I think we limit language only to description. I mean, we know that language helps us describe the shirt is green, the coffee is wonderful, you know, whatever. That is descriptive language. But there is another sense of word made flesh, or of the word, as John puts it, present from the creation that creates. It is when you say, you are my friend. See? This doesn't only describe a sense of connectedness. This creates that connectedness. And there is a sense in which this binds you to that connectedness. Do you hear what I'm saying? And the language of relationship, and especially the language of committed relationship, I will be with you. I love you. I marry you. I take you to myself, or you are my child. I mean, these things, there is a sense in which they are descriptive. There's a deeper sense in which they are creative and evocative and bring to substance, to creativity, that which wasn't there before. Before someone said, you are mine. I am grateful to the scripture for the way it says this happens in countless ways. And I am grateful to you for having listened with me to these words. So thank you for that. And we will break now. Any of you who need to leave, may leave. Any of you who want to stay are free to stay. Okay.